On behalf of our family, I want to echo Jay's remarks earlier and welcome everyone here tonight as we gather to commemorate the 11th yard site of my mother, which is just finishing now, and the first one for my father, which will be next Thursday. We had a wonderful morning of learning with women that, am I saying this right? This morning with Smadar Rosenzweig. And we look forward to continuing learning about Miriam tomorrow. So any ladies are welcome and encouraged to come tomorrow morning, BAYT at 9:30 in the morning. This Shabbat, we will be reading Parshat Korach, which of course details Korach's rebellion against Moshe and Aharon. And the Parsha begins with the words, Vayikach Korach, and Korach took. But we are not told what he took, which opens itself up to many possible explanations. Rashi says Korach seduced the heads of the Sanhedrin with soft words. Masechet Sanhedrin says he took a bad business for himself. And Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch says he assumed the right to himself. The Chovot HaLevavot, the primary work of Bachaye ibn Pekuda, an 11th century philosopher, offers us some insight as to where and why Korach went wrong. He tells us, and I'm paraphrasing very, very loosely, that one who trusts in Hashem should be genuinely concerned for his family, his friends, and I'll take the liberty of extending it to one's community as well. He should support them and avoid causing them any harm, and all this so as to fulfill the verses in the Torah, V'ahavta l'reyacha kamocha, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. We should do and act properly, not because we hope to be rewarded, but rather to fulfill the will of Hashem. If one does something with an ulterior motive, it will ultimately be in vain. If there are selfish motives to one's actions, they are doomed to failure, which is why Korach failed. However, when one acts out of true concern, success is generally assured. My parents both exemplified this quality of acting out of concern and love for others and not looking for personal accolades. When there was a void, a need to be filled, my father stepped forward and filled it with my mother's complete support. My father didn't consult the experts or strike committees when he first got involved in the field of special education. A congregant came to him upset that his developmentally delayed child could not have a bar mitzvah. And my father said, why not? And saw that it took place. And the rest, Kadima, Ezra, Sha'arim, Rina, among others, became realities that have helped thousands of people around the world. And as mentioned before, this is a legacy that continues and that we as a family are very proud of and continue to learn from. We are going to be looking forward now to hearing, I'm going to turn the podium over to my brother Maury, from Rabbi Beryl Rosenzweig, a childhood friend of my father, past president of the Rabbinical Council of America, professor of history at YU, Yeshiva University, as he reminisces about the Toronto of the 30s and the 40s when my parents were growing up, and we'll hear from Rabbi Shield as well. And we found out some things at supper that we didn't know about my father, so I'm looking forward to finding out what we're going to find out.
My sister basically, I think, introduced her. Rosenzweig, I'll just really say one word in terms of when we're thinking of appropriate speakers for the Yahrzeit, for this event, one of them, the first real natural thought was to Rabbi Rosenzweig, as my sister mentioned, grew up together with my father in Toronto and is also a great historian, so I think it's very appropriate on all those levels, together with the idea of having his own son and his daughter-in-law come here. It's a wonderful idea, really, of Kibbutz Av Ve'Em within their family, connected to our family. I'll just mention, I don't know if Rabbi Rosenzweig was going to mention my uncle Avraham in New York, who my father used to speak to every single day. I've tried to keep that tradition up as well. He just told me two nights ago that Rabbi Rosenzweig's great-granddaughter is now a student in his own yeshiva, Prospect Park, in New York, and came over, a six-year-old girl, I think, came over to him to send regards. So I think it's a wonderful Kesher connection between the families, and we look forward to hearing.
First of all, let me tell you that as I look around and I see a number of familiar faces, even some faces that with whom I grew up and who will understand and appreciate fully what I'm talking about when I talk about the Toronto of the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. This evening is dedicated to the first Yahrzeit of my boyhood friend, Rabbi Chaim Yosef Kelman, Zichrono Livracha. We grew up in a certain kind of world. And it's always hard to replicate these things. It was a different kind of world, and I'm going to talk about that in a few moments. But in order to be able to understand what that world was really all about, let me start off with a Medrash. The Medrash says, Lo nitna ha-Torah ela b'midbar. The Torah was given in a desert. The rabbi said, B'makom hefker, in a no man's land. And that has a profound lesson to teach. One of the great rabbis asked, why did God choose the Midbar, the desert, in which to give the Torah? Wouldn't it have been much more logical, much more realistic, to give the Torah in Yerushalayim? Even better, on the site of the Beis HaMikdash. And his answer was instructive. And he said that if the Torah had been given in Yerushalayim, people would have said that the Torah is valid and is obligatory only in so far and so long as the Jew lives in his holy homeland. Once the Jew is separated from Eretz Yisrael, from the Holy Land, that obligation no longer exists. And so therefore the Torah was deliberately given in a desert in order to tell us that the observance of the Torah, the commitment to its commandments, is not dependent upon any one given place. Judaism can be practiced in any setting, in any time, in every clime, even in a spiritual midbar, even in a wilderness, even in a moral no man's land. And really, it's against that background that you have to look at the Toronto of the early part of the 20th century. When I was a boy growing up in Toronto, Toronto was not that large a city, Jewishly. Even actually, I mean, Thornhill was a village of its own, incidentally. If there were 25,000 Jews in Toronto, there were a lot. The main area where Jews were concentrated was bounded by Spadina and McCall. I was born on Baldwin Street and spent my early years on D'Arcy Street. And then Toronto began to move a little. The Jewry of Toronto began to move a little onto College Street. And streets like Manning and Euclid and Palmerston and Markham and Lippincott began to emerge. The Jews in Toronto, interestingly enough, were also a mixed bag. The great majority of Jews were Polish Jews. Next in order came the Galiciane, the Galician Jews. And then after them, the Russian Jews. And finally, the Litvakis, the Lithuanian Jews. German Jews, Erwin, didn't show up until after Kristallnacht. And Hungarians, not until after World War II, and Sephardim probably towards the end of the 50s and the early 60s. That was Toronto. Toronto was also a mixed bag in the kind of Jews that we had. There was a significant number of very anti-religious Jews. A lot of leftists, socialists, Bundisten. Some of the extremists amongst them used to stand outside the shul where I davened, for example, on Shabbos, making fun of the people who would go in to daven. I even remember once that some group there amongst them had a Yom Kippur night ball in a hall which was directly opposite the shul where we were davening. That was one aspect of it. On the other hand, there was still a significant number of Jews in Toronto whose commitment to Judaism and to Torah was absolute and complete. There were Jews whose love for learning was all-consuming. These people worked like dogs during the day. And then at night, when they were through and they came home, they ate a quick meal and made their way to the Beis Medrash. I knew Jews who went through Shas 12, 13, 14 times without benefit of a Daf Yomi. I still remember there was a Jew called Dovital Handler. He davened in the Chevr Shas. Anyways, the years went by, and I was the rabbi of Shari Tfila, and his son, Jack, was a member in my shul. One day I hear that Jack lost his mother. So I went to be Menachem Avil. I come in the middle of the afternoon. Jack happened not to be there, but his father was there. And when I walked in, he looked up. He recognized me. He remembered me as a little boy, but he still recognized me. And his face turned as red as a beet. Why? I caught him. He had a Gemara in his hands. And he said to me, and I'll never forget it. He says, Rebbe, he says, Ivet nefagev me, you'll forgive me. But since I'm 7 years old, there hasn't been a day in my life that I haven't learned Gemara. That was the kind of Jew there was. I looked up to them. The problem with many of them was that while they were content with themselves, They had a sense of foreboding and defeatism when it came to their children and to their future in America. They would sit and sigh and lament, Dalton, there. I'll give you the Yiddish and translate as I go, because I know some of you don't understand Yiddish. In Yana Zayt Yam, on the other side of the ocean, in Rusland, in Galicia, in Poland, in Litva, dort not me gekent sein a Yid. Aber da, in Amerika, sind in a fila de steiner treif. Here, there, on the other side, there one could be a Jew. In Poland, in Russia, in Lithuania, in Galicia. But here in America, even the stones weren't kosher. And unfortunately, they followed it to their conclusion. And their children were not their fathers. Not by any stretch of the imagination. Realistically, they weren't that wrong. If you read the literature of the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, what you're reading, in effect, are eulogies over the impending demise of Torah Judaism. They said there was no future for what we call authentic Judaism. And they consigned us to the limbo of obsolescence. That created what is called, I don't know if they still use the terminology, but they used it in my time, the lost generation. Fortunately, there was a small number of Jews who looked at the situation and came to a different conclusion. There were a small number of Jews who said that even here in America, it's possible to build a vitalistic Judaism even on the pragmatic soil that is Canada and the United States. And they said, Lo me'ever le'yami. It's not on the other side of the ocean where you can be a Jew. And like Kolev ben Yefune in last week's Sedra, in the story of the Meraglim, they said, Oloi nale v'yorashtu oisa, ki yochol nuchalo. Let's go up and inherit it, because we can do it. They didn't deny the problems. They didn't overlook the fact that it was not easy to create Jewish life in America. But they had a greater faith. They looked beyond the moment. And they said, Oloi nale, let's go up and do it. Ki yochol nuchalo. One way or another we can do it. And the result was that two yeshivas appeared in Toronto. You know, you always need two yeshivas because you need one yeshiva where you're not going. Zeklal Godel. Two yeshivas appeared in Toronto. One was called Yeshiva, one was sponsored by Eitz Chaim. It was called Yeshiva Smaril Grobart. It was named after Rav Yehuda Leib Grobart, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the Stasher Berov, who was a giant, who was the Pelisher Rav in Toronto, and the author of the Chavol and Banimim. And the other one was Yeshiva Toras Chaim, where I attended And Joe attended, and Erwin Shield, who was here, attended, and Louis Lefko, who I saw over there, attended. Oh, there you are, Louis. And Seymour Brudner. I see you all. I still remember you. We looked a little less white, but we were still there. At any rate, those were the two schools. It was a yeshiva, but not like the yeshivas that you know today. Because they met in the afternoon. There were no day schools. We went to school in the morning. And then about 3:30 when we came home, we grabbed a bite, and we rushed off to the yeshiva to get there around 4, and we stayed till 7:30 every night. And if you think it was easy, it wasn't. But remarkable things were done. When I look back at the experience I had in Yeshiva Torah Chaim, I'm sometimes amazed at what we did accomplish. Merul Grobart had a Rosh Yeshiva whose name was Rav Yankov Kamenetsky. Zecher Tzadik Livroche. Without it denigrating anyone, on the contrary, we had his equal, at least. In Rabbi Avram Aaron Price, Zecher Tzadik Livroche. These institutions weren't overwhelming. How many boys do you think we had? There's a very famous picture of the time when I was about 10 or 11 years old, of the boys, of all the boys in Yeshiva Torah Chaim. It looks very sweet. You know, I'm wearing knickers, I still remember, like today. And I looked over and I said to myself, how many boys were there in this picture? Which they represented 99% of the boys who were there. There were less than 40 boys. And my real Grobart didn't have any more. So between the two yeshivas, there were less than 100 boys. And we grew slowly. We made a leap forward in 1940 when the German young Talmidei Chachamim, who Rabbi Price discovered in the wilds of Ontario, came to our yeshiva. And it was there, in Yeshiva Torah Chaim, that I met Joe Kelman. And the Kelman family. Yeshiva Torah Chaim was on 414 Markham Street, on the corner of Markham and Ulster. Remember? Yeah. 414, you'll agree with me. The Kelman's home was 408 Markham Street. And I want you to know it was an open house. Laura, Sarah, you'll agree with me. An open house for many of us, including me. It was like a second home. We were in and out all the time. It was a remarkable family. The oldest, and not only was it remarkable, but the truth is, little did I know at that time, that over the years, my life and my children's life on different levels would intertwine. Avram, who is the oldest, and he should have Arichas Yomim, he, incidentally, and Gedalia Felder, were the first two to receive smicha in Yeshiva Torah Chaim. And I dare say they represent the first two smichas ever given in Toronto. Avrom for 6 months was my Rebbe. And in 1950, when he left Toronto, I succeeded him in Beis Yehuda. He went on to Prospect Park, where he was unbelievably successful. And he created a wonderful girls' school, which is L'Shem Ulsiforis to this day. And Maury is right. My great-granddaughter will be in grade 5 there next year. Chavi is a very special little girl, and she's in a very special little school. Wolf was a surprise to me, I think to a lot of people, when he decided to become a rabbi. He went to the Jewish Theological Seminary, and he became the executive vice president of the Rabbinic Assembly. He was a tremendous koyach, a tremendous force. And Wolf and I literally, for many years, sat together. We were together in the Synagogue Council of America. He representing the conservatives. I was head of the delegation for the Orthodox. We were together in Itchkik, where we had discussed relationships with the Catholics and the Protestants. And then we would sit together in the President's Conference, which dealt with Israeli problems. And Wolf literally insisted that I had to sit next to him every time. And I did. We used to enjoy each other's company. And every time an issue came up, he'd give me a nudge, and he'd say to me, "Beryl, after all, you're a Luntzman. You have to vote my way." So that is the truth, I'm telling you. So I would look at him, I put a big smile on my face, and I said, "Wolf, I agree with you. And for that reason, I want you to vote my way." And this we kept on for years. Then there was Celia. Celia married Rabbi Melech Silver. Am I right, Maury? Who founded a yeshiva in Eastern Parkway. He died much too young, and I know that Celia is no longer here either. Laura, you were a friend of hers. I remember. And then there was Chaim Yosef. Joe and I were the same age, and we quickly bonded, and we became fast friends. I said this morning to one of the members of the family that when he was a youngster, Chaim Yosef Kelman was very quiet and very reserved. And they were shocked. And I said, "It's true. When he came into the rabbinate, he transformed himself. But by nature, he was very quiet. But from the very beginnings, that I knew him, he was an unbelievable person of substance with a sensitivity to human nature and to human life, which would be reflected later on, as Maury indicated before. He and I went through Yeshiva Torah Chaim together. We were together in Harvard Collegiate. And then in 1944, he and I and Seymour Brudner, who was sitting right there, went to Yeshiva University. He and I stayed on to complete the college and ultimately to gain smicha and to go into Rabbonis. And then finally, years later, both of us practiced right here in Toronto. But beyond that, he connected with my family. Jay was too old to have my son as a Rosh Hashiva. But Maury wasn't. And Maury, the Lezayin Gezunt, was a Talmud of my son's. And his grandson, Tova's daughter, Josh, his daughter, Tova's son, you see, at my age, you can make these mistakes. Josh is a Talmud of my son's right now. And then, of course, there was Toby. That was your friend, Sarah. Toby looked very much like her mother. She was married to a rabbi, and she died very young, much too young. And finally, there was Chayala, or Claire, whatever you like. And the interesting thing is that Claire's son, Rabbi Donnie Goldstein, was a Talmud of my son's and a student of mine. Whatever Jewish history he knows, it's because of me. For better or for worse, of course. And he became a rabbi in Brooklyn, very successful, and lives now in Eretz Yisrael, as does his mother. And on top of his whole family was the Rebbetzin. She was a remarkable lady. Erwin, you'll agree with me. Remarkable lady. Not only was she the mother of six children, widowed at the time, she had her parents, the Fishes, whom she looked after as well. And with all of that, that woman was a dynamo. She headed the League for Shmirah Shabbos in Toronto. And she and a whole group of women and men would go out on Shabbos to boycott those Jewish stores that were open. You didn't know that. Remarkable woman. Bright as could be, insightful in every sense. The family was remarkable and continues to be so. That was the context in which we knew each other. That was the context in which we grew up, literally. And that is the context which created the first steps in the revitalization of Jewish life in Toronto. The steps were slow. You know, when I came back to Toronto in 1950, wet behind the ears, my first position, I discovered that the shul had an express minyan. Now, you heard of an eshkama minyan, correct? But did you ever hear of an express minyan? No. An express minyan was for Shabbos morning, for people who were saying Kaddish, who had to get to work, wanted to make sure that they said Kaddish, and so they had an early minyan. Davened everything. And then off they went. In Beis Yehuda, I had a Jew who prided himself in the fact that he was a Ger Chassid, that his father was so important that when he was a boy, he was allowed to lie under the table of the Ger Rebbe. And he came to shul every Shabbos religiously. The shul was on Dover Court. And as soon as the davening was over, he would take off his talis, put it together. He'd walk out of the shul on Dover Court, walk over to Bloor Street, make a left turn into his furniture store, where his wife and his two children had been all morning. You have to understand the reality of Jewish life in that particular period of time. Not always deliberately, but realistically. And therefore the process of rebuilding Jewish life in Toronto was a slow one. By the time I came back in Toronto in 1950, the first steps in the day school movement were emerging. There were two schools at that time, Eitz Chaim had a day school, and there was the Associated, which was really a spin-off of the Brunswick Talmud Torah. And they were competing for students because there weren't that many. And slowly but surely, things began to change. When I came to Toronto in 1950, the number of Balabatim in my shul who were real Shomer Shabbos was probably less than 10%. It was an Orthodox shul, technically, but the Balabatim weren't. When I left Toronto in Shari Tfilah in 1968, more than 50% of my Balabatim were Shomer Shabbos. And most of them were young. These already were the products of the day school movement. And they were going to make a tremendous difference. I think J.B. earlier today rhymed off for me a whole series of different schools that exist here in Toronto today. Who would have believed it? But the truth of the matter is, if not for us, if not for the first steps that our fathers took and that we followed in, none of this could have happened. Rabbi Kalman spent his years in Toronto and he achieved unbelievable things. Particularly for those who were disadvantaged. The number of schools and institutions that he created and the impact that they have had to this very day are a reflection of the fact that the Torah can be given even in a desert and that Oloi Nale V'Yorashnu Oiso is not a myth, but it's a reality. And thank God, it's because of people like him, and I'd like to hope a little bit of people like myself, and others who are here probably as well, that this efflorescence of Jewish life has taken place. As we remember the memory of my boyhood friend, let's remember the struggles that we had to go through and the achievements which are simply its results. Oloi Nale ki yochol nuchalo. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for that really beautiful, moving reminiscing, and we're going to hear a little bit more. If you don't, please don't leave. If you can stay, we're going to call upon Rabbi Irwin Shield, and I'll thank both of them afterwards. Rabbi Irwin Shield, as mentioned, also grew up in Toronto, and he has a lot of wonderful memories as well. I think he wrote a very fascinating book about his experiences and wants to share some of his experiences to read from his book a little bit. So it's very much an honor. Rabbi Shield spoke at my father's Levaya as well. And it's a longtime friend of Sarah as well. So it's a pleasure also to call upon Rabbi Shield.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Rabbanim, I cannot say as Rabbi Beryl Rosenzweig did that I grew up in Toronto. I sort of was parachuted into Toronto very unexpectedly. No act of volition on my part, really. But I want to perhaps compliment the reminiscences of my good friend Beryl, whom I see every day, incidentally. I see Beryl every day, at least all every weekday, I should say, because the screensaver on my computer in my shul office has a picture of the top class of the yeshiva with Rabbi Price at the head of the table and along the side, the first one facing the camera was that time called Beryl Rosenzweig, still called Beryl, maybe, and myself is on the picture, and Finney Kurtzel of Shalom, and Mr. Margulis. So that's the picture I see every day. But I thought rather than rely on my own memories, I've done this already when I wrote my second book, The Very Narrow Bridge, which is my autobiography. There's naturally a great deal about Toronto and about Robert Price and about the yeshiva. And I'm particularly glad that Robert Price's granddaughter Barbara is here with us. And many other people here, Sarah Edel, as she was then, is in the book, and many of the other people that some of you will remember. Maybe some of the tensions in the community are recorded, or at least mentioned, in my book. So I'll have some patience, and I will read some relevant passages from my autobiography, and I'll be certain to read the section that deals with the Kelman family that played an important part in my life, too. As Rabbi Rosenzweig mentioned, Rabbi Price was able to liberate us from the internment camp that was in 1942, January and February 1942, we came to Toronto. We traveled from the internment camp was incidentally in Quebec on the Île-aux-Noix, which is now a national park, Fort Lennox. Should visit it sometime, very interesting, a beautiful spot. This is Robert Price and the yeshiva is the heading of this chapter. We traveled from Montreal to Toronto by train. At Union Station, we were met by a number of board members and supporters of Robert Price's yeshiva. They escorted us to their cars and drove us to a festive dinner that was waiting for us at the Talmud Torah building on Brunswick Avenue near College Street. We were impressed by the unaccustomed luxury of private cars. I was driven by Mr. Sam Kurtz, who was, as I found out later, the administrator of the Talmud Torah. He was one of the finest, wisest, humblest, and most effective servants of the Toronto Jewish that the Toronto Jewish community ever had, deserving credit for the subsequent growth of his school into the Associated Hebrew Schools of Toronto. That I was his passenger on my wintry arrival in Toronto was pure chance, of course, but both Mr. Kurtz and I kept the memory of this coincidence alive with mutual satisfaction. A crowd of Rabbi Price's followers, members of the yeshiva circle, were on hand to greet us. our arrival in Toronto was hailed as a major event in the traditional community. Rabbi Price welcomed our group of 30 yeshiva students as a significant remnant of European Torah scholars. It was a remnant originally saved by flight to Britain, and now liberated from captivity again, thanks to his efforts and the support he had received from his followers. At the time, his praise may have been a little overblown, since most of us were still too young to have become scholars. But the rabbi had correctly assessed the potential of our group and its stimulating effect on the community. Indeed, among the group were former students of famous yeshivot in Lithuania, Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. It included a number of pious Hasidic young men, recognizable by their garb, beards, and earlocks, along with serious students raised in the traditions of mainstream Western and Eastern European Orthodoxy. Rabbi Price, Polish-born and educated, had lived for several years in Berlin before fleeing from the Nazis to Paris. He was very familiar with the distinctive strengths and weaknesses of German Torah scholarship and the social conditions of German Jews. He welcomed us and appreciated the influx and influence of well-educated students from German cities and villages. Before our arrival, Yeshiva Torat Chaim, located in a converted dwelling on the northwest corner of Ulster and Markham Streets, was a small school. That it existed at all was due to the drive, ambition, and genius of Rabbi Price. Its somewhat grandiose description on its letterhead as the Rabbinical College of Toronto was not undeserved. As Dean of the Yeshiva, one of the rabbi's favorite titles, he had ordained, when I came, he had already ordained three rabbis, Abraham Kalman, Alan Langer, and Gedalia Felder. The three graduates had already left the yeshiva before we arrived and had begun their distinguished careers in the rabbinate. Rabbi Kalman occupied a position in Toronto in which I would eventually succeed him. Rabbi Langner had a position in Montreal. Rabbi Felder had become rabbi of the Jewish congregation in Belleville, Ontario, and would grow to be a prolific author of books on Jewish law and a world-renowned scholar. At the time of our arrival, there were few mature students at the yeshiva. There were three young men from Winnipeg whose fathers were rabbis in that community and wanted their sons to study with Rabbi Price because of his reputation as a brilliant scholar had already spread in the Torah world. There were a number of local youths who studied part-time with the rabbi while attending high school or preparing to go into business. These students, while outnumbered by the newcomers, extended a warm welcome to us and would soon help us adjust to Toronto and to our new life. The yeshiva had also classes for younger elementary or high school students who received their Jewish education at the yeshiva 4 days a week after school hours and on Sundays. With our arrival, the yeshiva had now acquired a large number of senior students. This enhancement of the student body raised the profile of the yeshiva and strengthened Rabbi Price's position in the community. Now, I will not continue reading this chapter because it's really an appreciation of Rabbi Price. It's not an objective one, but it's also not one that sees only the good and not the bad. It's an objective appreciation of a wonderful person, great scholar, Rabbi Price, delineating his greatness and not being silent about his weaknesses either. If you want to read that some other time, it's available here. I just want to read one thing that is maybe off on the shadow side. Rabbi Price, was a controversial figure in Toronto Jewish community, particularly in the politics of the Orthodox core of the community. I have no desire to delve into the arcane details of the political process that consumed the energies and passion of community activists at that time, nor am I really equipped to deal with them, for my close relationship with Rabbi Price gave me not only a privileged but also a slanted insight into the controversies. While these disputes are part of the history of our community, they are incidental to my biography, except that a few times I was personally involved in them, to the point of being sued by the editor of a local Jewish newspaper. In retrospect, these events no longer trigger my passion. The fact that these controversies divided our community at a time when millions of Jews, kith and kin of the local combatants, were being done to death in Europe, relegates the controversial issues to a realm of grotesque irrelevance. Rabbi Price had been invited to Toronto before the outbreak of World War II, not only to head the yeshiva and to lead the small but learned Chavrishas congregation, but also to spearhead a religious political faction. The young, prolific, outspoken, dynamic, and audacious scholar, already acknowledged as a rising star on the firmament of Polish Torah scholarship, was imported to counterbalance Rabbi Yudalite Greg Robart and later Rabbi Yosef Kamenetsky, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Lithuanian-style savants. They were the rabbinical authorities of the D'Arcy Talmud Torah and Maharil Grobart Yeshiva faction, whose political leader was the fiery Itshemaiah Korolnik. Remember that anybody mentions Itshemaiah Korolnik? The battle arena included the Kehillah, the strife-torn official religious community organization charged with the supervision of Kashrut. Who was the authentic arbiter of halacha for the community? That was the issue. Today, we would consider the petty, spiteful quarrels of those years embarrassing, to say the least. However, the factional strife created its own momentum and continued for many years. Only after a new generation grew up and had to face critical problems in the wider Jewish world were the old issues of internecine warfare consigned to the dustbin of history, in which the embarrassments of yesterday are forgotten. Well, I don't want to continue this here. The thoughts about Rabbi Price and his relationship to the students. We call him the chief, you know, the students called Rabbi Tribe the chief. In most otherwise, the chief was like a father to me and to the members of our group. He was concerned for our welfare and progress, always sensitive to the needs of young men who had been wrenched away from their families in such difficult circumstances. Although the rabbi was strictly observant and expected his disciples to adhere to Jewish rules and to Jewish spirit, he was not coercive. He understood us. He treated us as responsible adults and was tolerant of our need for general education and for recreation to recover from the emotional ordeal that we had experienced. His piety was tempered or enhanced by common sense and by an easygoing sense of humor and geniality that may have been part of his Hasidic heritage. His halachic opinions were generally liberal and shaped by a sensible, pragmatic perspective, but they always were based on sound and thorough halachic reasoning, of which he was a master. I am convinced that he deserved the highest rank among his scholarly peers. Again, it was his pugnacious streak, his inability to appreciate opinions contrary to his own, and his brutal frankness that obscured his genius and isolated him. That did not bother him. He corresponded with many renowned members of the Torah world and was satisfied to entrust his reputation as a scholar to the numerous books he wrote. Indeed, there are firm evidence of his unique genius. Rabbi Price was about 42 years old when I arrived in Toronto. Our close relationship underwent changes in the ensuing decades. Yet when he died during Pesach in 1994, 52 years after I arrived in Toronto, I was the first person, I believe, whom his granddaughter called at dawn. I think that was right. Now let me read a little bit about the Kelman family. It repeats a little bit of what Rabbi Rosenzweig said, but from a different point of view. Only two houses and the width of Ulster Street separated the home of the Kelman family from the yeshiva. Its proximity, and even more, the hospitality of its residents, made it a favorite place for the students to visit whenever we wanted to temporarily escape from the institutional ambience of the yeshiva to the warmth of a real family home. The Kelmans were also fairly recent immigrants. They had arrived from Vienna in 1930, years before the Anschluss turned Austria into a part of the Nazi Reich. Thus, they had sincere sympathy for the newcomers. Yeshiva students were always welcome in the home and found the members of the family to be understanding, friendly, and gracious. Unfortunately, the family had also been touched by tragedy. Rabbi Zvi Yehuda Kelman, father and husband, who had served as a rabbi in the community, had died at an early age in 1936. Rabbitson Kelman was a wonderful, well-educated, and thoughtful person, a model of Jewish piety and hospitality, and her aged father shared the family home. It was a lively place. There were three sons and three daughters, all more or less in the age range of the new yeshiva students. All three sons were to become distinguished rabbis. The eldest, Adolf, who for obvious reasons preferred to use his Hebrew name Abraham, had already been ordained by Rabbi Price, and as I mentioned, I eventually succeeded him as the rabbi of his congregation. The second son, Wolf, at the time serving in the Royal Canadian Air Force, later played a leading role in the conservative movement as the executive director of the Rabbinical Assembly. The third son, Joseph, a few years younger than I, grew up to be a beloved colleague and friend serving a great Toronto synagogue. One Saturday night in the spring of 1942, a few months after my arrival, the end of Shabbat found me in a melancholy mood. I neither felt like studying nor reading. So I left the dormitory and ambled over to the Kelmans. There was a piano in the living room. I enjoyed playing the piano, though my formal piano training had been minimal. For years, I had watched my talented brother play, and I had learned enough to improvise popular songs and melodies with enough skill to make them sound good, as long as I transposed everything into the key of C. I began to express my mood that evening by playing some sentimental Hebrew songs and a few popular numbers such as Indian Love Call. Celia, the oldest of the Kelman daughters, was in the kitchen entertaining a number of her girlfriends. The girls saw me arrive at the house and they heard me play, but they were too bashful or coy to join me in the living room. All except one, a tall girl with lovely long hair, came into the living room, leaned her elbow on the top of the piano, and though she did not say very much, obviously enjoyed listening and watching. I do not remember our conversation, although I am sure we exchanged some words, but I was sufficiently impressed to ask Wolf Kelman about her when I saw him on the street a few days later. "Oh, Laura Sachs," he replied. "She is very nice, but I believe she has a boyfriend." Let me read it a little bit more. I was timid in my progress on the field of romance, but no impediment slowed the advance of my studies. I was doing well. My study partner was Joel Litke, who had been one of the more advanced scholars at the yeshiva in London. I derived immense benefit from studying with the more experienced students, and I tried hard to keep up with him. Despite our reverence and appreciation for Rabbi Price as a scholar and as our teacher and benefactor, Joel and I preserved a measure of independence and objectivity. We paid a courtesy visit to Rabbi Price's political antagonist, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenitsky. We wanted to show that our respect for an outstanding Torah scholar of the Lithuanian school transcended politics. Our courtesy was intended to make a statement that although we were loyal disciples of Rabbi Price, we had not lost our admiration for a noted scholar from the school whose approach to Talmud had guided our studies in London. Rabbi Kamenetsky received us graciously and showed a friendly interest in our background, our studies, and our future hopes. Although Rabbi Price neither criticized nor commended us for our visit, I am sure he understood our message. Well, let me just, have we got some more time? Okay, we finished. Just a bit of the background for the yeshiva. The rabbi had every reason to be satisfied and proud. Acting independently, without the support of the official community structure, he had been able to obtain the release of all these religious students. He had ventured right into the lion's den, the Department of Immigration in Ottawa, where he had successfully confronted F.C. Blair, the director of the department, who had steadfastly resisted the entry of Jewish immigrants. He was the author of None is Too Many, as far as Jews is concerned. Rabbi Price appealed to Mr. Blair's devout Christian sentiments in pleading for the admission of young Jewish scholars. Impressed by Rabbi Price, whose appearance and bearing conjured up the image of a biblical part patriarch or prophet, Blair yielded. Although the leaders of the Canadian Jewish Congress have disputed Rabbi Price's version of the events, it was clearly the rabbi's recollection that the official Jewish establishment had not shared his enthusiasm for making the release of yeshiva students a priority. Jewish communal leaders were cautious, mindful of the precarious position of the Jewish minority in a society still rife with anti-Semitism. They did not want to appear as the champion of foreigners who were held in camps because of their alleged connection with the enemy, Germany. They were on safer grounds when pressing for the release of engineers, farmers, and skilled workers who might be helpful to the Canadian war effort, what could young students of Torah contribute? Perhaps the rabbi gloated a little, having succeeded against the odd, without the support or endorsements of the official Jewish community, as his yeshiva had truly become a place of serious scholarship. All right, I think that's where I'd stop. Anybody wants to read more of the books, that's still available.
Thank you. All right, I just want to thank again everyone who came here tonight helping us to fulfill what Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig discussed in his shiur, the idea of Kibud Av V'Em, honoring our parents, continuing even after they are no longer physically with us. So we're continuing our efforts to keep that mitzvah over Shabbos as well, as my sister mentioned, for women tomorrow at 9:30 at the Beit, the wonderful program with Professor Smadar Rosenzweig. And then over Shabbos, we'll have the real pleasure of hearing all the Rosenzweigs at different points, helping us learn Torah together to keep the memory of our parents alive, which we will do as long as we're around. So we thank you again in coming tonight. There's some refreshments at the back again, and we wish everyone a good evening. We'll be davening Marav in about 5 minutes or so. We'll daven Marav in here. So thank you.